From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 31st day of March, 2025. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. It's USDA Report Day. Coming up, we'll talk about the prospective plantings and grain stocks figures with Kurt Kimmel from agmarket.net. We'll get some perspective on that report as it's related to the ARC PLC decision farmers must make by the midpoint of April. And then we'll hear again from Aaron Hager, scientist at the University of Illinois, about endless soybeans and 2,4-D. We'll put that into perspective of Springfield and legislation and take up water hemp in detail as well. You want to listen to that. And then as we close out our time, we'll take up the weather forecast with Mark Russo at Everstream Analytics on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
May corn for the day settled at $4.57 and a quarter. It was four higher. July, $4.63 and a quarter, up three and a quarter. December, down a half. It settled at $4.42. The May beans at $10.14 and three quarters of a cent, 8¼ cents lower a bushel. July, down nine. $10.28 and a quarter, the settlement price there. New crop November soybeans, $10.19 and a quarter, down nine and three quarters. Bean meal, 80 cents lower. The bean oil, down 27 cents. Soft red winter wheat, up seven and three quarters at $5.50 and a half, and the hard red at 570, up 4 and a half, both of those in the harvest month July. Live cattle futures down $1.20, feeders off 67 and a half cents, and lean hogs were 50 cents lower. This morning's USDA report showed prospective plantings of 95.326 million acres of corn. That's 105% of what was planted last year. And soybeans at 83.495 million acres. That's just 96% of last year. Again, 95.3 for corn. AgMarket.net actually at 95.4. And soybeans at 83.5. AgMarket.net had their number at 82.8. Those numbers were not too far off. Actually, really good in the broad perspective of the analysts that were reporting pre-report estimates. Thank you, Kurt, for being with us today. I appreciate it, Mr. Kimmel, for being along. You guys did a good job.
Well, the team did. I did not really put a whole lot of input in it, to be honest with you, but the team did their homework. And once again, they were right in there on it. Yeah, it's kind of neat to be able to be close to it. And yeah, Matt and the guys did a fantastic job of looking at that. So, but that's behind us now. It's called opening day for the grain market now. And what I refer to that is we've got the acreage estimates now, and those are the top number on the supply demand balance sheet. And so where do we go from here? Well, there's a lot of moving parts as far as what type of yield, what type of demand to put on it and see what that bottom line is. Early ballpark estimates, when you look at the bottom line, as far as this coming year's carryout, we'll know that here in May, but corn carryout is probably in this 2.1 to 2.2 area. Bean carryout, 2.80 to 3.10. But, you know, when you talk tariffs, you talk yield, that's going to fluctuate quite a bit. Rewind and fast forward, rewind over a year ago, the carryout started at on corn at about 2.1, pushing 2.2. Then if you look at the supply demand balance sheet, now we're down to 1.5. So these are benchmarks to go by, and we'll see how things unfold as we move forward. Other hit and misses, the cotton came in at 9.86. The average trade estimate was 10.1. Outlook meeting was about 10. So we lost some cotton acres there. Some shifting there. Probably the biggest miss in my part, at least, was sorghum. Sorghum acres 6.5. Average trade estimate was 6.0. Last year, they were 6.3. And I was under the impression that a lot of those Kansas guys were going to shift to corn due to the fact that they've just got a bunch of Milo sorghum sitting around due to China being absent out of the marketplace. So One kind of offsets the other in through there. So we've got the acreage numbers. We'll see what the weather forecast brings now.
Yeah, just as to where things changed, Iowa 105% for corn acreage over last year, Illinois 103%, Nebraska 105%, Minnesota 105%, South Dakota 107%, Kansas 102%, and Indiana at 104%, North Dakota 106%. So everybody planting more corn. That consequently meant soybeans were down. Illinois, the largest soybean state, down 3% to 97% of last year. Iowa at 96%, Minnesota 95%, North Dakota at 94%. Grain stocks numbers were also out today. There were some expectations that they might show something unique and different. They did not, as least as it was related to the trade. Those stocks came right in at the trade numbers, 8.15 billion bushels in the bin for corn, 1.91 billion for the soybeans. So I don't suppose there's much to talk about there. Then you turn your attention to South America. What are we hearing from that size of the crop?
Yeah, we'll continue to focus on it, but we're going to continue to look at the divergence between what the southern hemisphere is projecting, what the northern hemisphere is projecting on their production and demand and so forth. I think that is going to remain wide. For the most part, they've been receiving some beneficial rains, and we'll see how that crop comes along and through here. But the other part of the equation is overall world logistics, world demand here as Liberation Day takes place here on Wednesday, April 2nd.
Did today's marketplace and reaction to the USDA reports change anything in your mind as it's related to corn and soybean marketing?
Well, technically, it's kind of supportive here from the chart point of view. We went down and matched or close to the March lows on old crop corn. Friday's price reversal to the upside kind of held in place. We've been recording some lows here towards the end of the first part of the month here, so hopefully that trend will continue. If you look at the momentum indicators, we do have a little bit of bullish momentum indicator, bullish divergence indicating that these lows we just made should hopefully be good here for a while. Some of the analysts have been promoting the bull spread in here, buying old crop corn, selling new crop corn on spread. There's ideas that that spread could widen out to 50 cents on that. So it sort of suggests that this old crop corn market, particularly this time of year, can hang in there from the point that seasonally we have some support due to the fact that producers have gone to the field and they're pretty well sold up to where they want to be. So those were kind of the two takeaways here from the last day or two's trading action there, Todd.
Thanks much, Kurt. Kurt Kimmel is with agmarket.net. Let's turn our attention now to the ARC PLC decision and tie those numbers to the USDA reports that took place earlier today. On Friday, Nick Paulson and Gary Schnitke, FarmDoc team members, ag economist here on the campus of the U of I, presented an ARC PLC webinar, which you can still find up on our website, actually the FarmDoc Daily website, under the Archives section. In it, they made the case that ARC County was definitely the choice for soybeans across the growing region and that they leaned slightly towards ARC County as it's related to corn. However, we did ask them what might make them change their mind about leaning towards ARC County for corn and using PLC, given at that point what might have happened in today's USDA reports.
We did have one question that sort of falls under this other consideration here. What USDA prospective planting corn acreage figure would you cause you to more fully commit to PLC? Which is a good question. Again, what people are expecting is corn acres to increase and soybean acres to potentially decrease in this upcoming report. And rather than state the acres, I'm going to state the thing that I would look at if a futures market reaction to it. Right now, the DEIS 2025 futures contract is trading at 440. If after the report on Monday comes out, you see that go down 20 to 30 cents, then you would be more fully looking at PLC. And again, we're not thinking much about soybeans changing much with that report.
That's Gary Schnitke from Friday afternoon discussing the potential for today's reports to change the Arc County lean towards decision that he and Nick Paulson had discussed during a webinar for corn. That decision needs to be made, the Arc PLC, by April the 15th. But producers and landowners across the United States for corn and soybeans both. As it happens, today's reports did not push the corn market down 20 to 30 cents, though the larger corn acreage that was released is likely to cause Gary and Nick to be less intent on our county, but still leaning that direction at this point, and certainly more intent that our county is the right choice for soybeans. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. The theme music is written, performed, produced, and courtesy of Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. You may find today's USDA reports on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. Let's return to some information you heard during last Friday's Closing Market Report about 2,4-D and Enlist soybeans. Today, we'll add a deeper discussion of controlling water hemp to the mix. The farm broadcaster Cesar Delgado from Ottawa had asked University of Illinois Extension weed scientist Aaron Hager a series of questions on the subject during a LaSalle County Farm Bureau meeting last week. He allowed me to pull a few of those sound bites. We'll pick up again with Aaron Hager reminding farmers that there are only two labeled formulations that can be applied post-emergence in 2,4-D resistant soybean varieties. Hager says these are Enlist One and Enlist Duo.
One of the things that we really want to emphasize this year around 2,4-D is its use in soybean varieties that are resistant to it, and those would be the Enlist soybean system. There are only two available labeled post-emergence products containing 2,4-D that can be applied in crop in Enlist soybeans. Those would contain the choline salt formulation of 2,4-D, in particular, either Enlist 1, which is 2,4-D choline by itself, or Enlist Duo, which is a premix of 2,4-D choline and glyphosate. There are no other salt formulations that can be used in crop, and we certainly do not want to use ester formulations in crop. Esters tend to have higher potential for volatility than salt formulations, and again, if we're concerned about off-target movement, applying an ester formulation in crop when air temperatures are typically going to be, you know, relatively higher than what they are when we use an ester in a burndown scenario, that is really something we discourage people from doing because it increases the likelihood of seeing damage to non-target vegetation across our landscape.
Again, no other salt formulations and no ester formulations can be applied post-emergence to 2,4-D resistant soybean varieties. Now, ester formulations are more volatile than salt formulations, and volatility can increase with the warmer air and soil temperatures that typically occur when post-emergence applications are made. For that very reason, volatility, or the ability of the herbicide to move in the environment, has caused over time a series of bills to be introduced in Springfield to ban the sale and application of 2,4-D ester formulations. Now, Hager says applying an ester formulation post-emergence in soybean could result in additional damage to non-target vegetation, trees, ornamental plants, and such, and increases the likelihood that a similar bill will advance through a future legislative process.
Well, it has actually been a concern that we've had for the last couple of legislative sessions. More than once, there's been a bill that's been introduced to ban the sale and application of ester forms of 2,4-D in the state of Illinois. That one is not likely to move out of committee for this legislative session, but again, in the future, it's likely to come back again. And another one that we're continuing to monitor, to watch, is a requirement for a proposed piece of legislation to require any pesticide applications within a half mile of a school or park that notification has to be given to the school, to the park, within 72 hours of when that application is scheduled to be made. So there's a lot of uncertainty with, you know, the distance, why is it a half a mile? You know, what, why 72 hours? Why would we need to, you know, make a notification if an application is made when the actual wind is blowing away from these particular areas? So we're keeping an eye on that one. I think there'll be some changes to it, but we're continuing to monitor that one.
Something else Hager has been monitoring is herbicide resistance in water hemp. Factually, he's been following that issue since, well, before it really became a thing.
Well, it's been interesting to watch water hemp in particular, because thinking back, I did my first plot work with water hemp 27 years ago. And when we were doing that work, we literally were driving from Champaign County to Bond County, which is just outside of St. Louis, because we really did not have water hemp in East Central Illinois to work with. Now, in the succeeding years, I don't think it's really a surprise to anyone how quickly, how aggressively this one species has now moved across the state, including now areas well into even Wisconsin and Minnesota, where it's now really become a problematic, and in many fields, it becomes the driver weed species. It's the species that is really driving the decisions that the farmers are having to make. What options do we have? We have chemical options, but we're reaching a point very, very quickly where the number of effective options, chemical options that we have, has been greatly reduced, and it's not going to increase in the future. So we will, you know, our story, if you would, to farmers is that we most likely will continue to use herbicides on most of our cropping acres. But we've really reached the point now where we have to think about what else can we do in addition to herbicides that is going to reduce the amount of seed that's produced at the end of the year. That's really the only thing that we know of right now, is that if there's no seed produced, then there's no change in the frequency of resistance. Anything short of that, and in all honesty, we're guessing.
This broad development of herbicide resistance within water hemp populations is the reason the U of I weed scientist says farmers must do more than simply make post-emergence applications. These, without a doubt, must be timed with when the water hemp first emerges from the soil.
Well, when I, and again, 27 years ago, we had a pretty good portfolio of both soil-applied and foliar-applied herbicides that could effectively control water hemp in both corn and soybean. Over time, that number has greatly diminished. We now have resistance in Illinois water hemp populations to herbicides from 7 different classes. And so we see resistance to foliar-applied herbicides. That's fairly easy to detect. But we also have widespread resistance to soil-applied herbicides, which is more difficult in many cases to actually confirm under field conditions. So obviously, most folks, I think, would be familiar when they see resistance to foliar-applied herbicides. They spray a herbicide on the population, and it does not die. But the way that we see resistance to soil-applied herbicides, the way that's manifest is that the length of residual control gets less and less. So, for example, if we normally would expect to get 5 to 6 weeks of good residual control of from a herbicide on a sensitive population, maybe that's now 3 weeks. Maybe that's even less than 3 weeks now, which again emphasizes the importance of, you know, continual monitoring of our fields so we know when the emergence actually takes place.
If you'd like to learn more, check out the weed management section of the University of Illinois Online Agronomy Handbook. Search Agronomy Handbook, and the University of Illinois link should be one of the first things in the results. Mark Russo now joins us. He's with Everstream Analytics. Hello, Mark. Thanks for being with us. We have a lot of ground to cover here in the United States. Planters will be rolling, certainly in some of the southern regions, as it's related to corn and soybean planting. Even in Illinois, they might roll fairly soon, if not already, although I think it's probably a little wet at this point. Can you tell me what conditions are like today and what they might be like for the next 7 to 10 days?
Yeah, overall, well, from a soil temperature standpoint, actually across much of the central and eastern Western U.S., except for far up north, soil temperatures are actually warmer than normal. In terms of soil moisture, it's quite variable across much of the ag belts here, across the central and eastern U.S. As we go through this week, a couple of key items. Number one is that temperatures are going to be cooling back down to near normal, even cooler than normal readings as we get into next week. No extreme cold is expected, but with this cooler bias, that will again begin to limit soil temperatures, but that is not a red flag right now. And then in terms of the rainfall outlook, actually we are going to see more of the Midwest Delta in a wetter than normal pattern, with even some pretty high amounts in and around the Ohio River Valley and northern Midwest. This is not a red flag right now, since it has been very dry in those areas, but that puts more emphasis on drier conditions returning later in the month.
In the second half of the month, do you see that to be the case?
Yes, the early signs point towards a less active pattern returning later in the month, and along with that, warmer temperatures is expected as well.
Tell me about the forecast for the hard red winter wheat growing regions of Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas.
Yeah, certainly in and around the Wichita, Kansas area, down into northern Oklahoma, that's been the driest area and acreage that needs rain the most here. There is going to be an opportunity for rain coming up later on this week and over the upcoming weekend, even extending into the early part of next week. It looks like an okay event, not widespread to solve the issues, but at least allow for a little bit of contraction here. So we do see this window of opportunity at least helping a bit, but does not look to completely solve the dryness issues there.
In the southern hemisphere, bring us up to speed on Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay, and Brazil, or at least the areas you see that are of interest.
Yeah, in Argentina, the wet pattern of the past week and a half, that is now coming to an end, and a drier pattern is following suit here for the next few weeks. That's actually a good pattern, favorable pattern for harvest progress. And after any brief delays here in the past week, this will help improve things throughout the first half of April. And then further up north into areas of Brazil, as well as adjacent Paraguay and Uruguay, we see generally favorable weather for soybean harvesting, also favorable weather for safrinha corn development. A few dry pockets here and there might be in place in the safrinha corn belt, but the net pattern does provide at least general improvement here coming up through mid-April.
Hey, thanks much, Mark.
You're welcome, Todd.
That's Mark Russo. He is with Everstream Analytics. Joined us on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report that came to you from Illinois Public Medium. It is public radio for the farming world, online, on demand, anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. There you'll today find the prospective plantings report on the homepage with state-by-state changes that may be of interest to you. And you can check all those numbers out. And under the USDA tabs, you'll also find the grain stocks figures. They're at willag.org. You have a good afternoon. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.